nothing gives them more pleasure than harming humans. Belief in the jinns is particularly strong here in Morocco. It's probably a holdover from the pre-Islamic beliefs of the traditional Berber religion. Just because Moroccans believe it doesn't mean it's true. It's in the Quran, said Yaakov defensively. That doesn't make it true either. There was another exchange of nervous glances between the three veteran office agents. Gabriel frowned. You don't actually believe this drivel, do you?
We heard a lot of strange noises in the house last night, said Dina.
It's probably infested with rats. Or jinns, said Yaakov. The jinns sometimes come in the form of rats.
I thought we only had one jinn.
Aisha is their leader. Apparently there are many others.
Says who?
Hamid, he's an expert.
Really?
And what does Hamid suggest we do about it? An exorcism. The ceremony takes a couple of days and involves the slaughter of a goat.
It could interfere with the operation, said Gabriel after giving the idea due consideration.
It could, agreed Yaakov. Aren't there countermeasures we can deploy short of a full-blown exorcism? All we can do is try not to make her angry. Aisha? Who else? What makes her angry? We can't open the windows, sing, or laugh. We're also not allowed to raise our voices. Is that all?
Hamid sprinkled salt, blood, and milk in the corners of all the rooms.
That's a relief. He also told us not to shower at night or use the toilet. Why not? The jinns live just beneath the surface of water. If we disturb them...
What? Hamid says we will suffer a great tragedy.
That doesn't sound good. Gabriel looked around the beautiful courtyard.
Does this place have a name?
Not that anyone can remember, said Dina.
So what shall we call it?
The Dar al-Jinns, said Lavon gloomily. That might upset Aisha, said Gabriel.
Something else.
How about the Dar al-Joasis? Asked Yaakov.
Yes, that was better, thought Gabriel. The Dar al-Jawasis. The House of Spies.
They arranged for the wives and eldest daughters of Tariq and Hamid to come to the house and prepare a traditional Moroccan meal. They arrived in short order, two plump, veiled women and four beautiful young girls laden with straw baskets overflowing with meat and vegetables from the markets of the old Medina. They spent the entire afternoon cooking in the huge kitchen, chattering softly in Darija to avoid disturbing the jinns. Soon the entire house smelled of cumin and ginger, and coriander, and cayenne. Gabriel poked his head through the kitchen door around 7 o'clock and saw endless platters of Moroccan salads and appetizers, and huge clay pots of couscous and tagine. There was enough to feed a village, so at Gabriel's insistence, the women invited the rest of their relatives from the bidonville to partake of the feast. They ate together in the largest of the courtyards, the destitute Moroccans and the four strangers whom they assumed to be Europeans, beneath a canopy of diamond-white stars. To conceal their facility with Arabic, Gabriel and the others spoke only in French. They talked of the jinns, of the broken promises of the Arab Spring, and of the murderous band of killers who call themselves the Islamic State. Tariq said that several young men from his bidonville, including the son of a distant cousin, had gone to the caliphate. The DST staged raids in the bidonville from time to time, and cut her off the Salafis to the Tamara interrogation center to be tortured. They have stopped many attacks, he said, but one day soon there's going to be another big attack like the one in 2003. It's only a matter of time. It was on that note that the meal concluded. The women and their relatives returned to the bidonville, taking all the leftover food with them, while Tariq and Hamid went into the garden to keep watch for the jinns. Gabriel, Yaakov, Dina, and Elie Lavon bade one another good night and retired to their separate rooms. Gabriel's overlooked the sea. One of the guardians had etched a circle around the bed in coal to protect it from the demons, and in the four corners were salted droplets of blood and milk. Exhausted, Gabriel fell instantly into a deep sleep, but shortly before dawn he awoke with a desperate urge to relieve himself. He lay in bed for a long time, debating what to do before finally checking the time on his mobile. It was a few minutes after 5 o'clock. Sunrise was at 6:49. He closed his eyes. Better not to tempt fate, he thought. Better to leave Aisha and her friends undisturbed. Chapter 47. Casablanca, Morocco. Later that morning, Jean-Luc Martel, hotelier, restaurateur, clothier, jeweler, international dealer of illicit narcotics, and asset of French and Israeli intelligence, boarded his private Gulfstream aircraft, JLM-2, at Nice's Côte d'Azur airport and flew to Casablanca. He was accompanied by his not-quite wife, his not-quite friends, who lived in the monstrous villa on the other side of the bay, and a British spy, who until recently had earned his living as a professional assassin. In the annals of the global war against Islamic terrorism, no operation had ever had such a beginning. It was a first, everyone agreed. Against all reason, and with no justification, they hoped it would be the last. Martel had arranged for a pair of Mercedes limousines to ferry the party from the airport to the Four Seasons. They roared past the flashy new apartment blocks and the squalor of the bidonvilles before turning onto the seafront corniche and making their way at motorcade speed to the hotel's heavily defended entrance. JLM and party were expected. As a result, the cars received only a cursory inspection before being waved into the motor court, where a small battalion of bellmen waited to receive them. Doors were flung open, and a mountain of matching luggage was loaded onto the waiting trolley. Then the baggage and its owners squeezed through the choke point of the magnetometer. All were admitted without delay, save for Christopher Keller, who twice set off the alarm. The hotel's chief of security, after finding no prohibited objects on Keller's person, joked that he must have been made out of metal. Keller's tight, unfriendly smile did nothing to allay his suspicions. A chapel silence hung over the cool of the refrigerated lobby, it being high summer in Morocco and therefore the low season for beachfront hotels. Followed by their caravan of belongings, JLM and party flowed toward reception, Martel and Olivia Watson dazzling in white, Michael and Natalie feigning boredom, Keller still smarting over his treatment at the door. The hotel's general manager handed over the room keys. As usual, Monsieur Martel had been granted the luxury of an advance check-in, and offered a few syrupy words of welcome. "And will you be dining in the hotel this evening?" he wondered. "Yes," answered Keller quickly. "A table for five, please." It was an upside-down hotel. Lobby on the top floor, guest floors below. JLM and party were on the fourth. Martel and Olivia were in a room together with Michael and Natalie on one side and Keller on the other. When the bags had been delivered and the bellmen tipped and dismissed, Michael and Keller opened the interior communicating doors, turning the three rooms effectively into one. "That's much better," said Keller. "Lunch, anyone?" The message arrived at the House of Spies shortly after noon, as Hamid and Tarek were standing over the toilet in Gabriel's bathroom, reciting verses of the Koran to drive away the jinns. It stated that JLM and the party had arrived safely at the Four Seasons, that there had been no communication from Mohammed Bakar or his surrogates, and that JLM and party were now sharing a lunch at the hotel's terrace restaurant. Gabriel fired the message securely to the op center at Kingsall Boulevard, which in turn forwarded it to Langley, Vauxhall Cross, and DGSI headquarters in Levallois-Perret, where it was greeted with a level of interest that far outweighed its operational significance. The prayers over the toilet bowl ended a few minutes after one. Lunch at half past. Dina and Yaakov Rossman departed the House of Spies a few minutes later in one of the rented cars. Dina was wearing a pair of loose cotton trousers and a white blouse and was clutching a shoulder bag that bore the name of an exclusive French designer. Yaakov looked as though he were about to make a night raid into Gaza. By 2 o'clock they were reclining in a private cabana at the Tahiti Beach Club and the Corniche. Gabriel instructed them to remain there until further notice. Then he turned up the volume on the audio feed from the three connecting rooms at the Four Seasons.
"Someone needs to bring the bag into the hotel," said Ailey Lavon.
"Thanks, Ailey," replied Gabriel.
"I would have never thought of that myself. I was just trying to be helpful. Forgive me. It was the jinns talking.
Laban smiled.
Who did you have in mind?
Mikhail is the most obvious candidate.
Even I would be suspicious of Mikhail.
Then maybe it's a job for a woman.
Or two, suggested Laban. Besides, it's time they declared a truce, don't you think?
They got off on the wrong foot, that's all. Laban shrugged.
Could have happened to anyone.
There was a security guard at the gate that led from the back of the hotel's secluded grounds to the Plage La La Meriem, Casablanca's main public beach. Dressed in a dark suit despite the mid-afternoon heat, he watched the women, the tall English woman whom he had seen several times before, and a French woman of sour disposition, making their way across the flat, dark sand toward the water's edge. The Englishwoman wore a shimmering floral wrap knotted at her narrow waist, and a top of translucent material, but the Frenchwoman was more modestly attired in a cotton sundress. Instantly the beach boys were upon them. They placed two chaises at the tide line and erected two umbrellas against the scalding sun. The Englishwoman asked for drinks, and when they arrived, tipped the boys far too much. Despite many visits to Morocco, she had no familiarity with Moroccan money. For that reason, and others, the boys fought over the privilege of waiting on her. The security guard returned to the game he was playing on his mobile phone, the beach boys to the shade of their hut. Natalie stepped out of her sundress and placed it in her Vuitton beach bag. Olivia unknotted her wrap and removed her top. Then she stretched out her long body on the chaise and turned her flawless face to the sun.
You don't like me very much, do you?
I was only playing a role.
You played it very well.
Natalie adopted Olivia's reclined pose and closed her eyes to the sun.
The truth is, she said after a moment, you're not really worth disliking. You were simply a means to an end.
Jean-Luc?
He's a means to an end, too. And in case you were wondering, I like him even less than I like you.
So you do like me, said Olivia playfully.
A little, Natalie admitted.
Two muscled Moroccan men in their mid-twenties walked past in the ankle-deep surf, chatting in Darija. Listening, Natalie smiled.
They're talking about you, she said. How can you tell?
Natalie opened her eyes and stared at Olivia blankly.
You speak Moroccan?
Moroccan isn't a language, Olivia. In fact, they speak three different languages here, French, Berber, and—
Maybe this was a mistake,
said Olivia, cutting her off.
Natalie smiled.
How is it you speak Arabic?
My parents were from Algeria.
So you're an Arab?
No, said Natalie, I'm not.
So Jean-Luc was right after all. When we left your villa that afternoon, he said that I look like a Jew from Marseille.
How do you know?
How do you think?
You were listening?
We always are.
Olivia rubbed oil onto her shoulders.
What were those Moroccans saying about me?
It would be difficult to translate.
I can only imagine.
You must be used to it by now.
You too? You're very beautiful.
For a Jewish girl from Marseille.
Are you?
I was once, said Natalie.
Not anymore.
Was it that bad?
Being a Jew in France?
Yes, said Natalie.
It was that bad. Is that why you became a spy?
I'm not a spy. I'm Sophie Antonov, your friend from across the bay. My husband is in business with your boyfriend. They're doing something together here in Casablanca that they don't like to talk about.
Partner, said Olivia.
Jean-Luc doesn't like to be known as my boyfriend.
Any problems? Between Jean-Luc and me?
Natalie nodded.
I thought you said you were listening.
We are, but you know him better than anyone.
I'm not so sure about that.
But no, said Olivia, he doesn't seem to suspect that I was the one who betrayed him.
You didn't betray him. How would you describe it?
You did the right thing.
For once, said Olivia.
the two muscled Moroccans had returned. One stared at Olivia without reserve.
"Are you planning to tell me why we're here?" she asked.
"The less you know," replied Natalie, "the better."
"That's the way it works in your trade?"
"Yes."
"Am I in danger?"
"That depends on whether you remove any more clothing."
"I have a right to know."
Natalie gave no answer.
"I suppose it has something to do with those shipments of hashish that were seized."
"What hashish?"
"Never mind."
"Exactly," said Natalie. "Anything I tell you will only make it harder for you to play your role."
"What's that?"
"The loving partner of Jean-Luc Martel, who has no idea how he really makes his money.
It comes from his hotels and restaurants."
"And his art gallery," said Natalie.
"The gallery is mine."
Drowsily, Olivia said,
"There's one of your friends."
Natalie looked up and saw Dina walking slowly toward them along the water's edge.
"She seems very sad," said Olivia.
"She has reason to.
What happened to her leg?"
"It's not important."
"None of my business. Is that what you're saying?"
"I was trying to be polite."
"How refreshing."
Olivia raised a hand to her brow to shade her eyes from the glare.
"It's funny, but it looks like she has the same bag as you."
"Does she really?" Natalie smiled.
"Isn't that a coincidence?"
It was the job of the security guard to monitor all passers-by along the beach, lest there be a replay of the unfortunate 2015 incident in Tunis, where a Salafist terrorist had pulled an AK-47 assault rifle from his umbrella and massacred 38 guests at a 5-star hotel, the majority of them British subjects. Not that the security guard could do much if faced with a similar set of circumstances. He had no weapon himself, only a radio. In the event of a terrorist incident, he was to issue an alert and then take any and all available measures to neutralize the attacker or attackers. Which meant that in all likelihood the security guard would lose his life trying to protect a bunch of half-naked, well-to-do Westerners. It was not the way he wished to die. But jobs were scarce in Casablanca, especially for boys from the bidonvilles. Better to stand watch on the Plage La La Meriem than to sell fruit from a pushcart in the old Medina. He'd done that, too. It had been a slow afternoon, even for August, and so the woman, approaching from the west, from the direction of Tahiti and the other beach clubs, received the guard's full attention. She was small and dark-haired, and, unlike most Western women who came to the beach, modestly dressed. There was a sadness about her, as though she had been recently widowed. From her right shoulder hung a beach bag, Louis Vuitton, a very popular model that summer. The guard wondered whether the woman realized that it cost more than many Moroccans would see in a lifetime. Just then, one of the women reclining near the water's edge, the unfriendly French woman, raised an arm in greeting. The sad-looking girl walked over and sat down at the end of the Frenchwoman's chaise. The beach boys offered to bring a third, but the sad-looking woman declined. Evidently, she would not be staying long. The tall, beautiful Englishwoman seemed annoyed by the intrusion. Bored, she stared listlessly out to sea while the Frenchwoman and the sad-looking girl talked intimately and shared cigarettes, which the Frenchwoman had produced from her own beach bag, also a Louis Vuitton. The same model, in fact. At length, the sad-looking girl rose and took her leave. The Frenchwoman, now wearing her sundress, walked with her for about 100 meters along the tide line. Then the two embraced and went their separate ways, the sad-looking girl toward the beach clubs, the Frenchwoman to her chaise. A few words passed between her and the tall, beautiful Englishwoman. Then the Englishwoman rose and knotted her wrap around her waist. Much to the security guard's delight, she did not bother with the sheer top. And he in turn was so distracted by the sight of her picture-perfect body that he did not bother to take more than a cursory glance inside their beach bags a moment later when they passed through the gate and re-entered the hotel's grounds. Together, the two women boarded an elevator and rode it to the fourth floor, where they were admitted into the row of three rooms that had been turned into one.
The tall, beautiful Englishwoman entered the suite she shared with Monsieur Martel. At once, he drew her close and murmured something into her ear that the Frenchwoman couldn't quite hear. It was no matter. Inside the House of Spies, they were listening. They always were.
Chapter 48 Casablanca, Morocco. There was no contact from Mohamed Bakar or his surrogates that night, and none the following morning either. From Kingsall Boulevard to Langley, and points in between, the mood turned bleak. Even Paul Rousseau, from his lair deep inside DGSI headquarters in Levallois-Perret, began to have his doubts. He feared that somewhere, somehow, the operation had sprung a leak and was taking on water. The most likely culprit was his unlikely asset, the asset he had burned and recruited without the consent of his chief or his minister, the asset to whom he had given a grant of blanket immunity. The hard young men around CIA Director Maurice Payne shared Rousseau's pessimism. Unlike the Frenchmen, however, they were not prepared to wait indefinitely for the phone to ring. They were soldiers by trade rather than spies and believed in taking the fight directly to the enemy. Payne, it seemed, was similarly inclined. He summoned Adrian Carter to his office and made his views clear. Carter, in turn, passed them along to Gabriel via a secure video conference. Carter was in the agency's counterterrorism center. Gabriel was in the makeshift op center at the House of Spies. "No big hand motions," he said. "Translation? Mohamed Bakar is the star of the show, and the star of the show gets to set the time and place of the meeting. Even a star needs good advice from time to time. It's not in keeping with the way the relationship has worked in the past. If I instruct Martel to initiate contact, Bakar will smell a rat. Maybe he already does. Calling him won't change that. The seventh floor is of the opinion it might settle things one way or another."
"Is that so?
And the White House, since when has the White House been involved in this?"
"They have been from the beginning. The President is said to be monitoring the situation carefully."
"How comforting. Exactly how many people in Washington know about this, Adrian?"
"Hard to say."
Carter frowned.
"What's that noise?"
"It's nothing.
It sounds as though someone is praying."
"They are."
"Who?"
"Tarek and Hamid. The caretakers. They're trying to drive away the jinns."
"The what?"
"Jinns," said Gabriel.
"I prefer mine with a splash of tonic and a lime."
Gabriel asked Carter about the status of the pair of drones that Maurice Payne had committed to the operation. One was a Sentinel stealth-surveillance drone. The other was a Predator. Carter explained that the Sentinel had been moved into the theater and could be airborne over Morocco as soon as Gabriel had a target. The Predator, with its two deadly Hellfire missiles, was on a hot standby. The CIA had no authority to launch a strike in Morocco. Only the President could. And even then, said Carter, it would have to be a last resort.
"The Moroccans," he said, "will go apeshit."
"How long will it take to get the Predator into position to take a shot?"
"Depends on the location of the target. 2 hours, bare minimum."
"2 hours is too long."
"They're not the swiftest cats in the jungle." "But all this is moot," said Carter, "unless Mohamed Bakar summons your boy to a meeting."
"He'll call," said Gabriel, and killed the connection. Privately, however, he was not so sure. And when noontime came and went with no contact, he succumbed temporarily to the same despair that had taken hold among his partners in Paris and Washington. He distracted himself by tending to his characters, the Antonovs and their friends, Jean-Luc Martel and Olivia Watson. He sent Martel and Michael into the wilds of Casablanca to view potential sites for a new hotel that JLM Enterprises had no intention of building. Natalie and Olivia he dispatched to the massive Morocco Mall, where, armed with Martel's credit cards, they pillaged several exclusive boutiques. Afterward, they shared a late lunch with Christopher Keller in the Quartier Gautier. Keller detected no evidence of surveillance, Moroccan DST or otherwise. Elie Lavon, who tailed Martel and Michael during their ersatz search for property, returned with an identical report. In mid-afternoon, with Gabriel's mood darkening, there was another crisis involving the jinns. Hamid had found an open window in one of the bedrooms. In point of fact, it was Dina's, and feared several new demons had entered the house as a result.
With Yakov, he raised again the idea of an exorcism. He knew a man from his bidonville who would handle it for a reasonable price, sacrificial goat included. Gabriel overruled him. They would rely on salt, blood, and milk, and hope for the best. Hamid was clearly dubious.
"As you wish," he said gravely, "but I fear it will end badly, for all of us."
By 5 o'clock, even Gabriel was convinced the House of Spies was haunted, and that Aisha and her fiery friends were plotting against him. He sent Natalie and Olivia down to the beach to catch the afternoon's last sun, and went for a walk alone, with no bodyguards or weapons, through the dirty arcades of old Casablanca. He wandered aimlessly for a time, across crowded squares, along boulevards thick with evening traffic, until he found a café where most of the patrons wore Western clothing. At a table in the darkest corner sat 3 Americans, 2 young men and a girl. In French, he ordered a café noir. Too late, he realized he had no Moroccan currency. It was no matter, the waiter was more than happy to accept euros. Outside, the din of the street was oppressive. It smothered the sound of the television over the bar, and the quiet conversation of the 3 Americans, and the vibration at 6:12 of Gabriel's mobile phone. He read the message a moment later and smiled. It seemed Mohamed Bakar wanted a word with Jean-Luc Martel in Fez the following evening. Gabriel dispatched a brief message to Adrian Carter at Langley before slipping the phone into his pocket. Then he ordered another coffee and drank it in the manner of a man who had all the time in the world for everything. Chapter 49. Fez, Morocco. A few minutes before noon the following day, Christopher Keller stood outside the entrance of the hotel, watching the porters loading the bags into the cars. Martel came along a moment later, followed by Mikhail, Natalie, and Olivia. He was holding a printout of the bill, which he handed to Keller.
"Give it to your people. Tell them I expect to be fully reimbursed."
"I'll get right on that." Keller dropped the bill into a rubbish bin and slid into the back of the first Mercedes. Martel joined him while the others climbed into the second car. They followed the coastline to Rabat, then headed inland through groves of cork oak to the foothills of the Middle Atlas Mountains. In spring, the hills would be green with rain and snowmelt, but now they were brown and dry. Olive trees thrived on the ridges, and in the lowlands were fields of irrigated row crops. Martel stared glumly out the window while Keller monitored the flow of emails, text messages, and incoming voice calls on the Frenchman's phone. With Martel's help, he dashed off responses to those items requiring immediate attention. The rest he ignored. Even Jean-Luc Martel, he reasoned, needed a holiday now and then. On Gabriel's instructions, they stopped for lunch in Meknès, the smallest of Morocco's 4 ancient imperial cities. It was there that Elie Lavon determined, conclusively, that they were being watched by a man, Moroccan in appearance, perhaps late 30s, wearing sunglasses and an American baseball cap. After lunch, the same man followed them to the Roman ruins of Volubilis, which they toured in the afternoon's fiercest heat. Lavon snapped a photo of the man while he was pretending to admire the triumphal arch, and sent it to Gabriel at the Casablanca safe house. Gabriel then bounced it to Christopher Keller, who showed it to Martel when they were back in the car again.
"Recognize him?"
"Maybe."
"What does that mean?"
"It means I might have seen him before."
"Where?"
"At the meeting in the Rif last December, after the attack on Washington."
"Who was he with, Bakar?"
"No," said Martel. "He was with Khalil."
It was approaching 6 when they reached the Ville Nouveau of Fez, the modern section of the city where most residents prefer to live. The next hotel, the Palais Farage, was at the edge of the ancient Medina. It was a labyrinth of colorful tile floors and cool, dark passageways. The owner had automatically upgraded Martel and Olivia to the royal suite. Keller was staying in a smaller room next door, and Mikhail and Natalie were down the hall. They took Olivia for a walk through the souks of the Medina, while Martel and Keller sat on the royal suite's private terrace and waited for the phone to ring. The air was hot and still. It smelled of wood smoke and faintly of piss from the nearby tanneries.
How long is it going to make us wait? Asked Keller.
Depends.
On what?
His mood, I suppose. Sometimes he calls right away, and sometimes...
What?
He changes his mind.
Does he know we're here?
Mohammed Bakar, said Martel, knows everything.
When another 20 minutes passed with no call or text, Martel stood abruptly.
I need a drink.
Order something from room service.
There's a bar upstairs, said Martel.
And before Keller could object, he was headed toward the door. Outside, in the foyer, he pressed the call button for the elevator, and when it didn't appear instantly, he mounted the stairs instead. The bar was on the top floor, small and dark, with a view across the rooftops of the Medina. Martel ordered the most expensive bottle of Chablis on the wine list. Keller asked for a café noir.
You sure you won't have some?
Asked Martel, holding a glass of wine approvingly up to the light. Keller indicated he was fine with just coffee.
No drinking on duty?
Something like that.
I don't know how you do it. You haven't slept for days. I suppose you get used to it in your line of work, added Martel thoughtfully. Spying, that is.
Keller glanced at the barman. The room was otherwise empty.
Have you always been a spy?
Asked Martel.
Have you always been a drug dealer?
I was never a drug dealer.
Ah, yes, said Keller. Oranges.
Martel studied him carefully over the rim of his wine glass.
It looks to me as though you spent some time in the military.
I'm not the soldiering type. Never been one to follow orders, don't play nicely with others.
So maybe you are a special kind of soldier. SAS, for example. Or should I call it the regiment? Isn't that how you and your comrades refer to it?
I wouldn't know.
Bullshit, said Martel evenly.
Smiling for the benefit of the Moroccan barman, Keller looked out the window. Darkness was settling on the ancient Medina, but there was still a bit of pink sunlight on the highest peaks of the mountains.
You should watch your language, Jean-Luc. The lad behind the bar might take offense.
I know Moroccans better than you do, and I know a former SAS man when I see one. Every night in my hotels and restaurants, some rich Brit arrives with a private security detail. And they're always ex-SAS. I suppose it's better to be a spy than an errand boy for some British bond trader who wants to look important.
Just then, Jossi Gabisch and Ramona Stern entered the bar and sat down at a table on the other side of the room.
Your friends from Saint-Tropez, said Martel. Shall we invite them to join us?
Let's take the bottle downstairs.
Not yet, said Martel. I've always liked the view from here at sunset. It's a World Heritage Site. Did you know that? And yet most of the people who live down there would gladly unload their crumbling old Riad or Dar to some Westerner so they can get a nice clean apartment in the Ville Nouveau. It's a shame, really. They don't know how good they've got it. Sometimes the old ways are better than the new.
Spare me the café philosophizing, said Keller wearily. Ramona was laughing at something Yossi had said. Keller checked Martel's incoming texts and emails, while Martel contemplated the darkening Medina.
You speak French very well, he said after a moment.
I can't tell you how much that means to me, Jean-Luc.
Where did you learn it?
My mother was French. I spent a lot of time there when I was young.
Where?
Normandy, mainly. But Paris and the South, too.
Everywhere but Corsica.
There was a silence. It was Martel who broke it.
Many years ago, while I was still in Marseille, there was a rumor going around about an Englishman who was working as a contract killer for the Orsatti clan. He was ex-SAS, or so they said. Apparently he was a deserter.
Martel paused, then added,
A coward.
Sounds like the stuff of a spy novel.
Truth is sometimes stranger than fiction. Martel held Keller's steady gaze. How did you know about René Devereaux?
Everyone knows about Devereaux.
It was your voice on that tape.
Was it?
I can only imagine the things you must have done to make him talk. But you must have had another source, Martel added. someone who knew about my ties to René, someone close to me. We didn't need a source. We were listening to your phone calls and reading your emails. There were no phone calls or emails.
Martel smiled coldly.
I suppose all it took was a bit of money. That's how I got her, too. Olivia loves money.
She had nothing to do with it.
Martel was clearly dubious. Does she get to keep it?
What's that?
The 50 million you gave her for those paintings. The 50 million you paid her to betray me.
Drink your wine, Jean-Luc. Enjoy the view.
50 million is a lot of money, said Martel. He must be very important, this Iraqi who calls himself Khalil.
He is.
And if he shows his face, what happens then?
The same thing, said Keller quietly, that will happen to you if you ever lay a hand on Olivia.
Martel was unmoved by the threat. Maybe someone should get that, he said. Keller looked down at the phone, which was shivering on the low table between them. He checked the number of the incoming call and then handed the device to Martel. The conversation was brief, a mixture of French and Moroccan Arabic. Then Martel rang off and surrendered the phone.
Well? Asked Keller.
Mohammed changed the plan.
When are you meeting him?
Tomorrow night.
And it's not just me, said Martel.
We're all invited.
Chapter 50, Casablanca, Morocco. Christopher Keller was not the only one monitoring Jean-Luc Martel's phone. At the Casablanca safe house, Gabriel was keeping watch over it, too. He had listened to the steady stream of voice calls throughout the long afternoon and read the many text messages and emails. And at 7:15 that evening, he eavesdropped on the brief exchange between Martel and a man who didn't bother to introduce himself. He listened to the recording of the conversation 3 times from beginning to end. Then he adjusted the time code to 19:16:13 and clicked the play icon.
Mohammed and his partner would like to meet your friends. One friend in particular.
Which one?
The tall one. The one with the pretty French wife and lots of money. He's Russian, yes? An arms dealer.
Where did you hear a thing like that?
It's not important. Why do they want to meet him? A business proposition. Do you think your friend would be interested? Tell him it would be well worth his while.
Gabriel clicked pause and looked at Yakov Rossman. How do you suppose Mohammed Bakar and his partner figured out how Dmitri Antonov really makes his money?
Maybe he heard the same rumors Jean-Luc Martel heard. The rumors we spread like chicken feed from London to New York to the south of France.
And the business proposition?
I doubt it involves hashish.
Or oranges, said Gabriel.
Then he said, It sounds to me as though the person who really wants to meet with Dmitri Antonov is Mohammed's partner.
But why?
Can we stipulate that Mohammed's so-called partner is Saladin?
Let's.
Maybe he wants to buy arms. Or maybe he's looking to lay his hands on some loose Russian radiological material to replace the supply he lost when that ship was seized.
Or maybe he wants to kill him.
Gabriel paused, then added, and his pretty French wife. Gabriel clicked play.
Where?
Drive south to Erfurt and...
Erfurt?
That's 7 hours at this time of year, maybe less. Mohammed has made arrangements for a couple of four-wheel drives. Those Mercedes sedans of yours will be useless where you're going.
Which is?
A camp in the Sahara. Quite luxurious. You'll arrive around sunset. The staff will prepare a meal for you. Very traditional Moroccan. Very nice. Mohammed will come after dark.
Gabriel paused the recording. A camp at the edge of the Sahara. Very traditional. Very nice.
And very isolated, said Yakov.
Maybe Saladin's thinking the same thing.
You think we're blown?
I'm paid to worry, Yakov.
Any suspects?
Only one.
Gabriel opened a new audio file on his computer
and after adjusting the time code, clicked play.
You speak French very well.
I can't tell you how much that means to me, Jean-Luc. Where did you learn it?
My mother was French. I spent a lot of time there when I was young.
Where?
Normandy, mainly, but Paris and the South, too.
Everywhere but Corsica.
Gabriel clicked pause.
He was bound to make the connection at some point, said Yakov. They come from the same world. They're two sides of the same coin.
Keller was never involved in the drug trade.
No, said Yakov archly. He just killed people for a living.
I believe in redemption.
I should hope so.
Gabriel frowned and clicked play.
But you must have had another source. Someone who knew about my ties to René. Someone close to me.
We didn't need a source. We were listening to your phone calls and reading your emails.
There were no phone calls or emails.
I suppose all it took was a bit of money.
That's how I got her, too. Olivia loves money.
Gabriel paused the recording.
He was bound to make that connection, too, said Yakov.
In the House of Spies there was silence. But in the royal suite of the Palais Farage, the inhabitants of Gabriel's operation were now quarreling about whether to dine in the hotel or at a restaurant in the Medina. They did so in the manner of the bored and very rich. So convincing was their performance that even Gabriel, who had created them, could not tell whether the row was genuine or staged for the benefit of the Moroccan DST, which surely was listening too.
Maybe we've lost Martel, said Gabriel at last.
Who knows? Maybe we never had him in the first place.
Is that the djinns talking again?
Gabriel said nothing.
He's been under our control from the moment we burned him. Blanket coverage. Physical, electronic, cyber. Keller's practically been sleeping in the same room with him. We own him, body and soul.
Maybe we missed something.
Like what?
A missing telephone patter. Or some sort of impersonal communication.
Newspaper, no newspaper? Umbrella, no umbrella?
Exactly.
No one reads newspapers anymore, and it doesn't rain in Morocco this time of year. Besides, said Yakov, if Mohamed Bakr thought Martel had switched sides, he would have never summoned him in the first place.
In Fez, the argument over dinner had grown genuinely heated. Exasperated, Gabriel settled the matter for them with a terse text to Mikhail. GLM and party would be dining at the hotel that evening.
Wise move, said Yakov. Better to make an early night of it. Tomorrow's likely to be a long day.
Gabriel was silent.
You're not thinking about aborting, are you?
Of course I am.
You've come too far, objected Yakov. Send them to the camp. Have the meeting. Identify Saladin and light him up, and when he leaves, let the Americans drop some ordnance on him and turn him into a puff of smoke.
Sounds so easy.
It is. The Americans do it every day.
Gabriel said nothing.
What are you going to do?
Asked Yakov. Gabriel reached down and clicked play.
You'll arrive around sunset. The staff will prepare a meal for you, very traditional Moroccan, very nice. Mohammed will come after dark.
Chapter 51 Fez, Morocco. Natalie awoke in sheets, drenched with sweat, blinded by sunlight. Squinting, she gazed out at the patch of sky framed by the window, momentarily confused as to her whereabouts. Was she in Fez, or Casablanca, or Saint-Tropez? Or was she back in the large house of many rooms and courts near Mosul?
You are my Maimonides.
She rolled over and stretched a hand toward the drawstring for the blinds, but it was just beyond her reach. Mikhail's half of the bed was still in shadow. Shirtless, he slept undisturbed. She closed her eyes tightly against the sun and tried to gather up the fragments of the morning's last dream. She had been walking through a garden of ruins. Roman ruins, she was certain of it. They were not the ruins of Volubilis, which they had visited the previous day, but of Palmyra in Syria. Natalie was certain of this, too. She was one of the few Westerners to visit Palmyra after its capture by the Islamic State.
and had seen with her own eyes the devastation the holy warriors of Isis had inflicted there. She had toured the ruins by moonlight, accompanied by an Egyptian jihadist called Ismail, who was training at the same camp. But in her dream, another man had been at her side. He was tall and powerfully built, and walked with a slight limp. An object of some sort, dripping and mangled, hung from his right hand. Only now, in the heat haze of morning, did Natalie comprehend that the object was her head. She sat up in bed, slowly, so as not to wake Mikhail, and placed her feet on the bare floor. The tiles felt as though they had just come out of a kiln. All at once she felt nauseated. She supposed it was the dream that had sickened her. Or perhaps it was something she had eaten at dinner, some Moroccan delicacy that had not agreed with her. Whatever the case, she was soon rushing into the bathroom to be sick. Afterward, her head throbbed with the opening shots of an encroaching migraine. "Today of all days," she thought. She swallowed 2 tablets of pain reliever with a handful of tap water, and stood for several minutes beneath a cool shower. Then, wrapped in a thin toweling robe, she went into the small sitting room and prepared a cup of strong black coffee with the Nespresso automatic. Madame Sophie's cigarettes beckoned from the end table. She smoked one for the sake of her cover, or so she told herself. It did nothing for her head. "You are very brave, my Maimonides. Too brave for your own good." If only that were true, she thought. How many might still be alive if she had found the courage to let him die? Washington, London, Paris, Amsterdam, Antwerp, and all the others. Yes, the Americans wanted him, but Natalie wanted him too. She went into the walk-in closet. Her clothing for the day lay folded on a shelf. Otherwise her bags were packed. So were Mikhail's. The labels spoke of exclusive manufacture, but the luggage, like Dmitri Antonov himself, was counterfeit. The smallest contained a false bottom. In the hidden compartment were a Beretta 92FS, 2 magazines loaded with 9mm rounds, and a sound suppressor. After Natalie agreed to work for the office, Mikhail had trained her to properly load and discharge a firearm. Now crouched on the floor of the closet, she quickly threaded the aluminum suppressor into the end of the barrel, rammed one of the magazines into the grip, and chambered the first round. Then she raised the weapon, holding it with 2 hands, the way Mikhail had taught her, and took aim at the man holding her head in his hand. "Go ahead, Maimonides. Make a liar of me." "What are you doing?" came a voice from behind her. Startled, Natalie pivoted and pointed the gun at Mikhail's chest. She was breathing heavily. The grip of the Beretta was wet in her trembling hands. Mikhail stepped forward and slowly, gently, lowered the barrel of the gun toward the floor. Natalie relaxed her grip and watched while he swiftly returned the Beretta to its original state and placed it in the hidden compartment of the counterfeit bag. Rising, he placed her forefinger to Natalie's lips and pointed toward the ceiling to indicate the presence of Moroccan DST transmitters. Then he led her outside onto the terrace and held her close. "Who are you?" he whispered into her ear in Russian-accented English.
"I'm Sophie Antonov," she answered dully.
"What are you doing in Morocco?"
"My husband is putting together a deal with Jean-Luc Martel."
"What kind of business is your husband in?"
"He used to do minerals, now he's an investor."
"And Jean-Luc Martel?"
She didn't answer. She felt suddenly cold.
"Would you like to explain to me what that was all about?"
"Nightmares."
"What kind of nightmares?"
She told him.
"It was just a dream.
It almost happened once."
"It won't happen again."
"You don't know that," she said. "You don't know how good he is."
"We're better."
"Are we? Really?"
There was a silence.
"Send a message to the command post," Natalie whispered finally. "Tell them I can't do it. Tell them I can't be around him. I'm afraid I'll bring down the entire operation."
"No,"
said Mikhail.
I will send no such message.
Why not?
Because you're the only one who can identify him.
You saw him, too, in the restaurant in Georgetown.
Actually, replied Mikhail, I was trying very hard not to look at him. I barely remember his face.
What about the security video from the Four Seasons?
It's not good enough.
I can't be in his presence, she said after a moment. He'll remember me. Why wouldn't he? I was the one who saved his miserable life.
Yes, said Mikhail. And now you're going to help us kill him.
He took her back to bed and did his best to make her forget the dream. Afterward, they showered together and dressed. Natalie spent a long time arranging and rearranging her hair in the mirror. How do I look? She asked.
Like a Jew from Marseille, said Mikhail, with a smile.
Upstairs, the hotel staff was clearing away the last of the breakfast buffet. Over coffee and bread, Mikhail read the morning papers on his tablet, while Natalie, affecting tedium, contemplated the ancient chaos of the Medina. Finally, shortly before 11, they went downstairs to the lobby, where Martel and Christopher Keller were seeing to the bill. Outside, Olivia was watching the porters tossing luggage into the waiting cars.
"Sleep well?" she asked.
"Never better," said Natalie. She ducked into the back of the second car and took her place next to the window. Her face, she did not recognize, stared back at her in the glass.
"Maimonides, so good to see you again."
Chapter 52 Langley, Virginia. The Counterterrorism Center had once been located in a single room on Corridor F, on the sixth floor of CIA headquarters. With its televisions and ringing telephones and stacks of files, it had looked like the newsroom of a failing Metropolitan Daily. Its officers worked in small teams dedicated to specific targets: the Red Army faction, the Irish Republican Army, the Palestine Liberation Organization, Abu Nidal, Hezbollah. There was also a unit formed in 1996 that focused on a little-known Saudi extremist named Osama bin Laden and his burgeoning network of Islamic terror. Not surprisingly, the CTC had expanded its size since the attacks of 9/11. It now occupied a half-acre of prime agency real estate on the ground floor of the new headquarters building, and was accessed through its own lobby and security turnstiles. Owing to security concerns, the real name of the CTC's chief was no longer a matter of public record. He was known to the outside world and to the rest of Langley only as Roger. Kyle Taylor liked the name. No one, he reckoned, was afraid of a man named Kyle. But a Roger was someone to be feared, especially if he commanded a fleet of armed drones and had the power to vaporize a man for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Uzi Navot had first encountered Kyle Taylor a decade earlier, when Taylor was working at the CIA's station in London. Their dislike of one another was mutual and instantaneous. Navot viewed Taylor, who was fluent in no language other than English, and therefore unsuited for work in the field, as little more than an indoor spy and a boardroom warrior. And Taylor, who harbored a traditional CIA resentment of the office and Israel, and perhaps a little more, regarded Navot as conniving and not to be trusted. Otherwise, they got on famously.
"Your first time in the center?"
asked Taylor, after easing Navot's path through security.
"No, but it's been a while."
"We've probably grown since the last time you were here."
"We had to. On any given day, we're running ops in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Syria, Somalia, and Libya." He sounded like a corporate salesman talking about his firm's unprecedented third-quarter expansion.
"And now, Morocco," said Navot quietly, egging Taylor on.
"Actually, given the political sensitivity of the mission, very few people in the building know about it. Even here in the center," Taylor added. "It's special access only. We're using one of our smaller op rooms. We'll be totally black."
Taylor led Navot along a corridor lined with numbered doors, behind which nameless, faceless analysts and operators tracked terrorists and plots around the globe. At the end of the hall was a short flight of metal stairs and another checkpoint through which Taylor and Navot passed without scrutiny. Beyond it was an ill-lit foyer and a cipher-protected door. Taylor punched the code rapidly into the keypad and stared directly into the lens of the biometric reader. A few seconds later, the door opened with a snap.
"Welcome to the Black Hole," he said, leading Navot inside. "The others are already here."
Taylor introduced Navot to Graham Seymour, perhaps forgetting they were well acquainted, perhaps not, and then to Paul Rousseau. "And Adrian, I assume you know."
"Very well," said Navot, accepting Carter's outstretched hand. "Adrian and I have been through the wars together, and we have the scars to prove it."
It took a moment for Navot's eyes to fully adjust to the gloom. Outside, it was early morning of what promised to be an oppressive summer's day, but in the restricted ops room deep inside Langley, it was a permanent night. At desks around the perimeter sat several technicians, their youthful faces lit by the glow of computer screens. Two wore flight suits. The two who were piloting the pair of drones now loitering above eastern Morocco without the knowledge of the Moroccan government. Images from the aircraft high-resolution cameras flickered on the screens at the front of the room. The Predator, with its two Hellfire missiles, was already above Erfoud. But the Sentinel stealth drone was southeast of Fez, thus granting its camera an unobstructed view of the Palais Farage. Navot watched as Christopher Keller and Jean-Luc Martel stepped into the hotel's forecourt. A few seconds later, two Mercedes sedans slipped beneath an archway and turned south toward the mountains. Navot sat down next to Graham Seymour. Kyle Taylor had pulled Adrian Carter into a corner of the room for a private consultation. The tension between them was obvious.
"Any idea who's running the show?" asked Navot.
"For the moment," replied Graham Seymour, "I say the ball is in Gabriel's court."
"For how long?"
"Until the minute Saladin shows his face."
"If that happens," said Seymour, "all bets are off."
The traffic in the Ville Nouveau was a nightmare. Even in ancient Fez there seemed to be no escaping it. Eventually the commercial buildings receded, and small plots of cultivated farmland appeared, along with new apartment buildings. They were three-level blockhouses, old before their time, with garages on the ground level. Most of the garages had been converted into tiny restaurants and shops, or were being used as pens for animals. Sheep and goats grazed among newly planted olive trees. Families shared picnic lunches in whatever shade they could find. Gradually, the land tilted toward the distant peaks of the Middle Atlas, and the olive trees gave way to dense groves of carob and argan and Aleppo pine. Eagles circled overhead, searching for jackals. And above the eagles, thought Christopher Keller, the drones were searching for Saladin. The first town of any significance was Imouzer. Built by the French, it was inhabited by some 13,000 members of the Aït Seglouchen, a prominent Berber tribe that spoke a distinct dialect of the ancient Berber tongue. The air was several degrees cooler. They were now above 4,000 feet in elevation, and the souks and male-only cafes along the main street were crowded. Keller scanned the faces of the young and old alike. They were noticeably different from the faces he had seen in Casablanca and Fez. European features, fairer hair and eyes. It was as if they had crossed an invisible border. Just then, Keller's mobile phone pulsed with an incoming message. He read it, and then looked at Martel.
"Our friends are under the impression we're being followed again. They think it might be the same man who was with us yesterday, in Meknes and Volubilis. They'd like us to get a better photo of him."
"What do they have in mind?"
Keller instructed the driver to pull over at a kiosk at the far end of town. The car carrying Mikhail, Natalie, and Olivia stopped behind them, as did a dusty Renault. In the side-view mirror, Keller could see the passenger, cropped dark hair, wide cheekbones, sunglasses, American baseball cap. But the driver was obscured.
"Get us a couple of bottles of water," he told Martel.
"It's not the friendliest of towns. I'm sure you can take care of yourself."
Martel climbed out and walked over to the kiosk. Keller peered into the side-view mirror
and saw the passenger stepping from the Renault. Through the heavily tinted rear window of the Mercedes, Keller snapped a photo of the passing figure. The result was a useless, blurred profile. But a moment later, when the man returned to the Renault, Keller captured a clear three-quarter image of the man's face. He showed it to Martel when the Frenchman slid into the back seat with two sweating bottles of Sidi Ali mineral water.
"That's definitely him," said Martel. "He's the one I saw in the Rif last winter with Khalil."
As the car eased away from the curb, Keller sent the photo to the Casablanca command post. Then he checked the side-view mirror. The second Mercedes was directly behind them. And behind the Mercedes was a dusty Renault with two men inside. Many years of close and sometimes controversial cooperation between the CIA and the Moroccan DST had earned Langley access to Morocco's long list of known jihadists and fellow travelers. As a result, it took the analysts in the counterterrorism center a matter of minutes to identify the man in Keller's photograph. He was Nasir Ben Said, a former member of the Moroccan Salafia Jihadia who was jailed after the Casablanca suicide bombings in 2003. Released in 2012, Ben Said made his way to Turkey and eventually to the Caliphate of ISIS. The government of Morocco was under the impression that he was still there. Obviously, that was not the case. A photo of Ben Said taken at the time of his imprisonment soon appeared on the display screens of the black hole in the CTC, along with another photo snapped in 2012 during the Moroccans' arrival in Istanbul's Atatürk airport. Both photos were forwarded to Gabriel, who sent them on to Keller. Keller confirmed that Nasir Ben Said was the man he had just seen. But what was Nasir Ben Said doing in a town of 13,000 Berbers in the Middle Atlas Mountains? And why was he now following Keller and the others toward Erfoud? It was possible that Ben Said had slipped back into Morocco to work in the hashish business of Mohammed Bakr, but the more likely explanation was that he was looking after the interests of Bakr's partner, the tall Iraqi who called himself Khalil and walked with a limp. Inside the black hole, the technicians digitally marked the Renault Sedan and its two occupants, while at Fort Meade in Maryland, the NSA locked onto the signals being emitted by their mobile phones. Adrian Carter rang the seventh floor to break the news to CIA Director Morris Payne, who quickly related to the White House. By 7:30, Washington time, the President and his senior national security team were gathered in the Situation Room complex, watching the video feeds from the two drones. At the House of Spies in Casablanca, Gabriel and Yaakov Rossman watched the video too, while down the hall, two caretakers prayed for deliverance from demons fashioned of fire. Through the speakers of his laptop computer, Gabriel could hear the excited chatter at the CTC and Langley. He wished he could share their optimism, but he could not. The entire operation was now in the hands of a man whom he had deceived and blackmailed into doing his bidding. "We don't always get to choose our assets," he reminded himself. "Sometimes they choose us."
Chapter 53. Erfoud, Morocco. The four-wheel drives were waiting in a hot, dusty square outside the Café Dakar in Erfoud. They were Toyota Land Cruisers, newly washed, white as bone. The drivers wore cotton trousers and khaki vests and conducted themselves with the smiling efficiency of professional tour guides. They were not. They were Mohammed Bakr's boys. South of Erfoud was the great Tafirelt Oasis, with its endless groves of date palms, 800,000 in all, according to the French-language guidebook Natalie clutched tightly in her hand. Gazing out her window, she thought again of that night in Palmyra and of her dream that morning. Saladin walking beside her in the light of a violent moon, her head in his hand. She looked away and saw Olivia watching her intently from the opposite side of the Toyota's back seat. "Are you all right?" she asked. Silent, Natalie stared straight ahead. Mikhail was in the passenger seat next to the driver. The second Toyota,
the one carrying Keller and Jean-Luc Martel, was about 100 meters ahead. Behind them the road was empty. Even the Renault, the one that had been following them since Fez, was nowhere to be seen. The palm groves receded. The landscape turned harsh and rocky. At Rissane, the paved road ended, and soon the great sand sea of Erg Chebi appeared. The village of Khamlia